At the third stroke, it will be...
Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to another episode of the EUC Digest, your audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be sharing stories about application management. And I know that sounds a bit strange, but today's guest is an expert on both. But before I introduce today's guest and dive into the topic of today, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Ingmar Verheij, and for this episode, I'm your host. With me today is Kees Bruggeman. Hey, Kees, how are you doing?
Hey, Ingmar. Doing fine, thank you. It's lovely weather out here in the Netherlands. So I'm actually enjoying the work shifting that we're allowed to do. A little bit of work in the evening and a little bit of sunshine over the day. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I'm interested to hear you just say that the weather is good. I used to say okay, but my wife told me not to say everything is okay because I say okay to everything. And I've been seeing it's raining all day. So, apparently different places. The sun is shining right now. So good hearing you again. Good seeing you, Case. Before we start introducing our guest of today, I'd like to take an opportunity first to thank our sponsor of this episode, which is Liquidware. Liquidware provides adaptive workspace management solutions for all Windows desktops. The company product encompasses all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, physical, virtual, DAS, or in the cloud. Now, Case, we're almost ready to introduce our guest, but did you find any interesting facts about our guests?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because we did find some interesting facts. So let's kick this off. Did you know that our guest of today is born, raised, and still residing in Chicagoland area? He went to the University of Illinois, where he majored in electrical engineering and pizza tossing. Our guest has a passion for applications. One could even say that applications have become part of his DNA. And while he worked at Citrix, he founded the Demo Warrior Contest. And for the sole reason, just to meet the Woz, Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple. And once upon a time, he met the creator of Toy Story, Finding Nemo, and Cars, and every day he takes these learnings to tell a story, until one day, well, more on that later on. And you might like this, Ingmar. He's also part owner of a private label whiskey brand, of which consumption is not outpacing sales. And some say that our guest is married twice. He's married with a Greek goddess, which explains his love for healthy food. And he has a work wife by the name of Eric, who was kind enough to help us uncover some interesting facts. And not all of them will be shared today.
All right. Well, for those who, based on this description, don't know who our guest is of today, can you please introduce yourself and what your current role is?
Wow, that was really well done. You guys did dig up quite a bit of dirt over there. The pizza crossing is an interesting one.
Yeah.
But that's a story for another time. So, Case, Ingmar, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Sumit Halvadia. I am CTO at Remo3. As these guys have mentioned, my entire two decades of professional tenure has been focused around applications and enterprise application management. So from my perspective, Remo3 was kind of the next generation of application management. So from my days at InstallShield to Flexera to AppDNA to Citrix to Remo3, I've really kind of focused on solving the app problem, so to speak, for enterprises as they start doing digital transformation and adopting new workloads and new work styles. So I'm really excited to be here and talk about apps and talk about all things Dutch for that matter.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming the pleasure is all ours. Thank you for being on the show today. I am really excited to having you in the podcast today. I mean, I think I first met you when I was in the finals of the Citrix Demo Warriors contest in 2016, which was in Santa Clara. So that's an experience by itself. It's actually the same contest that we covered in episode 9 of season 1. We did an episode with Nick Boving. He is one of the winners of the Demo Warrior contest. And so in the week that I was there with you, Sumit, we actually had a workshop with Matthew Lund, who is the authority on storytelling and created like many, many good stories at Pixar. And you've told me that you still apply the learning from that workshop with Matthew Lund like every day. Do you think that everyone can learn how to tell a story?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because when I started my career, it was in a pre-sales role, really at InstallShield. And one of the things that you talk about is, you know, I'm 22 years old. I'm learning about a brand new space around application packaging. I'm becoming a subject matter expert. And anytime you're talking to customers, we started talking about the technology, the features, the capabilities and stuff like that. And while sometimes that's an effective approach when you're actually doing some validation, I found really quickly, because the first book I read as a professional, and I'm using air quotes since you guys can't see me on the podcast, but the first book that I read in a professional capacity to help me become a better seller and just better articulate my ideas was a book by Annette Simmons called The Story Factor. And it was then that I became kind of enchanted with the ideas of weaving technology, personal experiences, and outcomes that your customers and partners have achieved with your technology to kind of paint a better view of what value you'd be able to provide both your customers and partners. And since then, I've just been looking at things like, you know, other mechanisms that we might be able to use to continue crafting better stories. And Matthew Lunn was one of my favorite experiences. So, you know, I'm glad we created Demo Warrior, and I'm glad that people got a lot of got a lot of great professional advancements out of it. But personally and selfishly, you know, you talk about me applying it to my day-to-day life. I've got an 8-year-old daughter, Ariana, and a 6-year-old son, Clark. And since 2016, basically, I use Matthew Lund's Story Spine every single night, and we make up stories. So for those of you not familiar with the Story Spine, please take a look. Give it a Google. It's worth kind of just applying to your day-to-day life because the premise is quite simple. Every single Pixar movie follows the same recipe, and I started applying it to every story that I tell when I'm working with customers and partners. So once upon a time, there was a blank, and every day that blank would blank until one day, and then you're able to wrap it up, right? It's such a simple concept, and you can actually apply it to so many different aspects of your life. And I'm continually using not just the Story Spine, but more and more around storytelling to make myself more effective, both personally and professionally. Now, the real question, Ingmar, from me back to you is, I remember applying the Story Spine when we were doing the Demo Warrior. Now, if you want to give the audience a brief overview of kind of what your experience was like for Demo Warrior, that'd be great. But I can still specifically remember the story. In fact, I can tell you what it is right now. So before you answer that question, that story was so compelling because you told me in a way that applied to your day-to-day life, you drive into the office. The door recognizes that it's you coming into the parking lot. You open the door. You've already reserved a hot desk based on your Citrix ID. Now you've already gone ahead as you've logged into your Citrix terminal. You've got the coffee machine going, getting you your favorite drink ready. Like, I remember exactly what that flow of that demo was because the story was so compelling.
Yeah, just, I mean, and to add to that, Dingmar, just 1 second, because people can't see us right now, but I'm nodding my head because I know that story. And I recognize every single kind of aspect you just mentioned to me. So every kind of step you took us through, I'm like, yes, I heard that. Yes, I'm recognizing that from the story that Ingmar has told us.
Yeah. So, and that's interesting because I hardly go into the office lately. So this is good that it resonated and really sticked. I mean, and the funny thing is that, I mean, I don't tell the story every night to my daughters, and I probably should brush things up on the learnings I did with Matthew Lund because it was just so wonderful. I was so lucky to get the workshop twice because we hired him again for Citrix Summit. But what I can tell you is that for whatever presentation that I do, or for whatever, basically the way I express something, even the way I prepare a podcast, is I try to tell a story. So there has to be a story. So whoever is watching a presentation, starting to ending, I want you to stay hooked. And there are hooks in part of that conversation. There are sometimes even ups and downs. I don't think in this podcast we have downs, but emotional roller coasters. Yeah, this was to me. So let's say thank you to me for making this happen, getting Magellan and what Kay said on Steve Wozniak. I remember that you showed me a picture of his watch, which was a Nixitube watch.
Yeah.
And because you showed me that picture and others as well, you somehow got me hooked and I ordered one of the same Nixitube watches, which is still a great conversation starter. It is. It's just so super cool. Super cool.
He was so happy to show it off. I remember like you and Sean Donahue standing by him and like he was holding court, telling people about the technology behind the vacuum tubes and how it worked. And I mean, you could tell that like he is the official and original Uber nerd that genuinely gets excited about technologies, you know?
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Just as a completely like a side note, Ingmar, if you're into storytelling to your kids, Rory's Story Cubes on Amazon, they're great. Like it's a little box of cubes that you can like a little box of dices that you can throw, and they have icons on it. And together with your kids, you can actually make up a story based on the icons on the little dices. So cool. Just as kind of a dad tip.
It definitely works with
my kids. Yeah, and it helps to kind of do the storytelling as well. Like, you get creative while doing that, right? So now, while we're talking EUC, how do you think our audience can benefit from storytelling in their day-to-day life or presenting to small or larger audiences?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, storytelling is the crux of it's been, if you've read, you know, Yuval Harari or any of the stuff around Sapiens and Homo Deus and 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, a lot of humanity in general has gone through the concept of gossip, which didn't always have such a negative connotation, right? Gossip is more about, you know, the powers of 12. You can trust up to 144 people before you end up, you know, achieving a level of intimacy that's you're incapable of continuing on, right? So if you start thinking about the way that things have been translated and kind of just effectively carried over time before the written word, it's always been through stories. It's always been through engagements, Greek mythology. There's tons of examples of this. And for EUC, it's really no different because, you know, I was listening to the podcast you guys did with T-Rex, and oftentimes, you know, He's just as guilty as I am. I love technology for the sake of technology. But what storytelling in the EU space, EUC space allows you to do is actually kind of focus on the outcome. And just kind of talking about this, like there's nothing sexy about compression and the algorithms you're going to use to save storage. But the outcome is, right? Like the outcome of being able to have more workloads and have a lower cost and still have a great user experience is based off of someone actually logging in and achieving that experience. So when I start thinking about the way that I like to position, you know, any type of technology or any type of benefit as it pertains to, you know, innovation in EUC, it's always tied to an outcome. It's always tied to a benefit. It doesn't have to be cost savings. It could be risk mitigation. It could be revenue generation. It could be a variety of different things, but it's the outcome. And that narrative needs to support an outcome. And then once you get that clicked down, you can start looking at what the technology stack looks like and the operational workflow to help you achieve that outcome. And I found that to be, well, because I'm not clever enough to understand all the underlying bits all the time. So I use the story as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, and also I think this is useful for everyone in whatever, if you're an engineer, if you're an architect, if you're a consultant. Everyone has a great mind and great ideas, and everyone has, you know, things you want to say. But if you're unable to express yourself, if you're unable to convey that message, then, you know, you get frustrated. So absolutely, if you have, you know, the capability of storytelling and better convey your message to your audience, I think, you know, that's going to benefit everyone. I mean, you do need storytelling to make applications sound sexy. They are definitely not sexy for me, but I mean, taking a few steps back, you started your professional career at InstallShield, and I intentionally skipped University of Illinois because I saw that in your LinkedIn. But is this where your passion for applications started?
It did. Oddly enough, so while I was in Champaign, University of Illinois, which is a respectable engineering school, it's rated quite highly. We did a great job of kind of doing labs and getting your hands dirty and doing some of the fun, innovative work around understanding what the future of semiconductors looks like and theoretically what we can start doing to speed up processors and stuff like that. So I'm dating myself a little bit here. But as we started getting out of school and I started finding myself doing day-to-day work on PC board designs for jet scans, which basically count currency, identify any, you know, counterfeit and things like that, it was so boring. I hated it so much. I immediately quit my job and I decided that I wanted to explore something else. And so I went into Marshall Fields, which a lot of folks may not know, but it is a local Chicago retailer. It's a historical part of the Chicago story, but now they're Macy's. So they're a clothing retailer. And what I did was I cut my teeth selling polo. So I sold Ralph Lauren for like 9 months and just started feeling comfortable with engaging with folks, understanding what they wanted to do, figuring out, oh, yeah, you know what? That's probably not the right shirt for you, but these pants will look good, you know, like based on where you're going. So, you know, I was kind of thinking about, am I mapping customer needs back to goods that I can provide? And I thought, well, if I can take the sales aspect, put things that I love like technology with it, I will find my way into a sales engineering role, which is exactly what I did at InstallSheet.
Okay, so it's more. So you basically moved from sales into sales engineering, and then rolled into technology, and therefore probably also applications.
Yeah, so at InstallShield, that's where I did find my love for applications, believe it or not. So considering that's what I did for a living, you know, people were like, hey, so what does InstallShield do? I'm like, have you ever clicked next, finish? That's what we do. We wrap whatever beautiful software you create into an installer and then send it over. But it was then, like, you know, that's usually when you're focusing with ISVs that are building software that they're taking to their customers. I didn't realize there was an entirely different side of the business, which we'll call the enterprise, which was really kind of focused. And MSI had just come out at that time, right? It's like 2002, 2003. It was still a new technology, but there was a whole new set of challenges that large organizations were facing, which is, well, when I deploy an application to my Windows XP 98 to XP environment, I don't know what it's going to do. This is back in the days of SMS 1.2. You know, this is when they were just ESD, electronic software distribution. You couldn't even call it like config manager or anything like that. You would just deploy a piece of software, cross your fingers and hope for the best. And when MSI tried to solve the problem of saying, you know what, we're not going to deploy a black box to another black box. We're going to open the application so you can see what changes it's going to make. That's when I started understanding the importance of application management as it pertains to Morgan Stanley still being able to run their data centers and their lines of businesses without fear of something breaking because you've deployed a change.
And that's also because of the – sorry for interrupting you again, Case, but I think this is also, you know, the results of the work of InstallShield, right? I mean, the MSI package essentially was a database which gives you some flexibility in how you install and allow you to uninstall. But having components in the middle, which where you can say, wait, let's do a check first and then have a, you know, a conditional logic built into your installer. I've only seen that happen with InstallShield back in the day. By the way, I've always found it very annoying, so I got it out because, you know, it didn't do what I wanted to do. But that was the hacker in me. But I did find it afterwards. It was like, hey, but this is super clever.
Yeah. And that's kind of a big part of it, right? It's bringing visibility to what was previously invisible. And that was kind of the thing that I'm like, oh, well, I mean, you're going to start seeing the impact of change. Because at that time, you're deploying and managing what? Maybe 100 applications in a huge estate back in 2002. You're not seeing, you know, massive thousands of applications with six different deployment methodologies, you know, some being delivered via. It was just a one-to-one. I'm going to locally install this electronically and hope for the best. And bringing a little bit of visibility and guidance was a compelling thing for me. And I've kind of continued down that path around enterprise application management. And just found that there's always new challenges to solve in that space, and I have yet to get bored from it.
Isn't it interesting that nowadays we try to do the opposite, right? We try to make the visible invisible by removing the complexity and doing that all on the background and giving admins and enterprises a comfortable feeling because it's so simple.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, all they want to know is they don't want to know how it's being done anymore. It's just that it's not going to break something when I make this change. It's not going when I send an application out, whatever it's being deployed as, whether it's a virtual package, whether it's, you know, sitting up in Citrix or whether it's sitting up in WVD, doesn't matter. I just want to know that when I push deploy, it's not going to break.
I think the similarity is
the outcomes. This time I'm going anymore. Now I'm interrupting you. So it's more about the outcomes than the actual technology. I guess that's kind of in line with the storytelling that you just mentioned, right? So people are so used to as a service or getting used to as a service that maybe we're shifting gears towards the actual outcome of an application migration or anything that is actually complex. And people being comfortable giving that out of control and giving that to somebody or an organization to actually create the outcome that was agreed upon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, that's the overlap here as well. Right? Both now and then, what MSI back then, and especially with Install Shield, what it gave you was a level of confidence and trust. Like, hey, if I send this MSI to my customer, there's a bigger chance that the Excel will install successfully. So there's less risk. There's less, you know, redo work, because back in the days when you got an EXE, then it failed. And then what? You know, then all hell broke loose because there was no proper uninstaller. Yeah. So I think, even today, yes, it's just being successful. Understanding you will be successful if you deploy that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing.
All right. So I mean, during your tenure at Install Shield, at some point, you got acquired by MacroVision, which was for $80 or $100 million. Back then, a lot of money.
Yeah.
What was that like?
A lot of money.
I mean, working for a company and then getting acquired.
Well, it was interesting because it was my first foray into the world of acquisition, right? Can you guys hear me okay? Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So it was my first foray into kind of the world of acquisition, so to speak, right? So I'd gone from being at a privately held company, headquartered, not really a huge global presence at that time, to going to a publicly traded company, which was very interesting because it was not in the same exact realm as us. So like when you start looking at any integration or post-acquisition integration, there's a lot of uncertainty. And when you're 24 years old, you're like, I don't know. Like, is this even a place I want to be? They're focused on licensing and software asset management. I'm focused on application management and just understanding how to best deploy an application to an end user. And for us, it was kind of a shift of mindset. But what it started kind of painting for me personally is there's much more to the application lifecycle ecosystem rather than just packaging, rather than just testing an application. It was really around, hey, do I need to buy a license? Is this something that I already have access to? Am I maximizing the efficiency of how I'm using concurrent licensing? And we started thinking about the concept of application lifecycle management, not just necessarily from a packaging and deployment perspective, but rather from an asset management perspective. So we started thinking about when is the right time to rationalize a piece of software? When's the right time to retire it? Can we save some costs by changing our licensing model? And that's where things got really interesting, because you went beyond just application deployment and application packaging into the first true, in my opinion, application lifecycle management offering. So it was an interesting transition, to say the least, and interesting enough where I stuck around because I thought that there was quite a bit of value. And luckily enough for me, they kept me.
So in 2009, you joined a company that is, I guess, close to both of our hearts, AppDNA. You became the VP of Global Technology and the Solution Group. Ingmar came up with a very corny joke saying that applications really became part of your DNA.
So good.
So good. Joking aside, can you tell us what AppDNA, before it got acquired by Citrix in 2011, what made it so special to you?
Yeah, so leaving Flexera, so post-MacroVision, it became Flexera. And it was a place that gave me every opportunity, and I can't speak highly enough of it. Still dear friends over there. Jim Ryan is still a dear friend. I went through a private equity acquisition after the MacroVision one with Orlando Bravo and Tomo Bravo and those guys. And I know they've gone through a couple more since then. But what was really interesting was that they did they focused on kind of taking and operationalizing a lot of pieces that were not as efficient as they could have been. So while there was some focus on innovation, there became a lot more focus on becoming a better company, right? A higher EBITDA, better multiples, being able to get software out more efficiently. And I think that it was exactly what Flexera needed at that time. But at that point, I felt like I'd run my course. And when Mike Welling actually approached me, there were zero people in AppDNA in America, right? We had one rep that was just starting. And Mike said, hey, we met in Las Vegas at a trade show. He's like, you seem like you love apps. You interested in coming over here and being an SE? And after a little bit of convincing, I took a look at the technology, and it was like unlike anything I'd ever seen at that time. I mean, and I've been in that app space for the last 6 years. So when I saw that, and I met Paul Schnell, the CTO, I couldn't join quick enough. I couldn't sign the dotted line any faster than I did. And what made it really special was the fact that we got to grow it from the ground up, right? There's six people at the company when we started, and two in the US, and we grew it to a really successful company based on the fact that we were at the right place at the right time in the market. We had actually a little known story about AppDNA, and since I'm sharing here in our circle of trust, we banked the entire static analysis testing methodology, because MSI is open, format. You can see inside what the application is going to do. And we did the same for the OS. And then we did static analysis with our algorithms to see, is there a risk of any type of conflict? And we banked our static analysis testing on the big motion of Windows XP to Windows Vista as a migration. which as we all know, never, ever even came close to fruition. So we're sitting there.
Epically failed. Yes, Vista failed horribly.
But we're sitting there and we're like, well, we've got this great piece of technology, and I don't know, like, no one's adopting Vista. We're AppDNA. We're not powerful enough to move the entire market to say, you need to adopt Vista, right? So we're sitting there and we're thinking, well, what are some of the other challenges that people are facing? And this is at the time of CPS 4.5, if you guys remember, Citrix Presentation Server, and they were releasing Tarpon, which was the Citrix app streaming technology.
App streaming, yeah.
Yeah. And Softricity had been acquired by Microsoft, and they'd just become AppV. So we pivoted the testing, because the testing could be done against any set of algorithms, right? So instead of looking for Vista, let's look for compatibility and feasibility for AppV and Citrix Streaming. And luckily, that did take off. People were very interested in moving their applications to app virtualization, which really gave us the opportunity to build the runway, the credibility, and market awareness over that next year until Windows XP to Windows 7 became a real thing. And then we were just off to the races. It was a surreal experience.
Yeah, what I really liked about AppDNA back in the day is also with AppV, because we were all basically involved in either doing Citrix Streaming or AppV, and luckily AppV won here. But can we make the package happen, right? Can we build the AppV sequence? But yeah. Will it work? And also, if it doesn't work, it was not just a red, orange, or green stoplight. Like, what's going to break, right? So what component is going to break? Is this relevant for me? Sometimes it's just one of those, rare use cases, which no user is going to click. So let's go ahead. And you had a remediation. So there were so many good things that I liked about AppDNA, like going to a customer and say like, hey, this app that you really like, it's really old, but we can make it happen. You just need to go to your ISV and tell them to do this.
Yep.
That was just so powerful. It wasn't like, hey, it's going to break and it's a black box.
Yeah.
You were able to fix it.
I recall one of the early days of a workshop in the Netherlands, and I think you weren't part of the Citrix family at that point in time anymore, but I'm fairly sure you were there. So was Nick Bouvink, who's now an SE at Citrix. And that was the moment that it clicked for me when we did that workshop, and we just we were able to put in random applications, and we got feedback from that, and that was so powerful. That was really the moment that it clicked for me. If you have this in your toolbox and you go to a customer, me as a consultant, if I have that in my toolbox, I'm pretty sure I can fix the problem. If it's not me, I'm at least able to tell where the issue is and how they can solve it, right? That's really, really powerful.
And what I also found very powerful, and I would just keep saying good things to you, Sami, but in your product, but what I also enjoyed when we are at the start of a project, we can just do, you know, 1 or 2 week exploring phase or discovery phase and tell the project manager, look, you need to scope the project. You need to know how long things are going to take. You need to know how many people you need. Hey, for these application, just hire wherever it was in the street they can click and just, you know, they can build a sequence. It will work. It's a green light. You just need the manpower. Yeah. But for these top 20% applications, hire the best you can because it's going to bring a lot of mess, right? So it also helped a lot of predicting how successful you're going to be, where you're going to fail, where it's going to be a red light and never going to work because you want to deploy in Vista maybe. But all just having, you know, being able to predict was something which I really enjoyed with AppDNA. And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't I able to automatically build FV sequences using AppDNA?
There were some that you would be able to build out of the box. Yeah, the straightforward ones. So, you know, it's funny that you're bringing up the fact that it's around planning, it's around decisions with data, figuring out the right resources at the right time as part of that migration, because the story hasn't changed around application delivery. In fact, you know, it's only become more complex. And this is my biased opinion, being an app nerd that I am. You know, the only reason I access a workspace is for my apps. And also for my app data, right? You know, I also care about my data and having a great user experience. But the reality is if you log into a beautifully fast, you know, Windows virtual desktop that has all the compute, but you have none of your apps, there's no reason for you to be in there, right? I mean, maybe you can stream Netflix and enjoy yourself, but the reality of it is you're in there. The workspace is a means to deliver your application. And since the AppDNA days, it's only gotten more complex. Back then, it used to be I'm just delivering an app V package to either server 2012 with Zenapp 6.5 on top of it, or I'm locally installing it. That's it. Those are my two ways I'm going to deliver the application. But now, those same legacy applications are being delivered as native installs or MSIX in WVD, app attach in WVD, as a local installation or, you know, in Citrix Zenapp, or it can be delivered in app volumes in VMware. Like, there's a variety of different ways that same application is going to be delivered. Are you sure that it's going to work in all of your delivery methodologies? And that's kind of the next evolution. So I like to call, you know, people are like, well, you know, Remo 3 is just AppDNA 2.0. And the reality is it's a completely different approach. And it's really AppDNA 4, maybe 5.0. But yeah, we still see that problem. Because, I mean, we talked about it even after Citrix acquisition, which is I don't think people still understand just how important and how pervasive the different application delivery models are going to be. And unless you can ensure that it's going to work on all 15 deployment types that you want, you're not doing yourself a good, you're not doing yourself a service.
Well, that's the deployment types you know of at that point in time, right? A technology that just keeps evolving and there's always this new next best thing and you want to be prepared for that as well. Yeah. So you mentioned two things that, that kind of, you mentioned adoption and you mentioned acquisition. So in 2011, Citrix acquired AppDNA, and you were at Citrix for about 7 years, and you got into SE enablement and pre-sales strategy. Now, we're not a sales-focused podcast by any means, but we read on your LinkedIn that you had a heavy focus on customer engagement and adoption. That to me are the two most important things in a customer relation, making sure they've got a great experience with the product and they actually use it. Would you agree on that?
110%, I do. I mean, you know, I come from the same days that you guys do. I mean, I might be a little bit grayer than you, but I think we're all in the same ballpark. But if we look at, you know, the old days of selling, it was kind of a perpetual sales cycle where you would come in and you'd say, here's a campus-wide license, 3 years, smell you later. I'll see you 3 years from now, and I'll ask you for another big check. And the reality is sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. But as applications evolved, applications moved away from being so data center centric to being more software as a service. And now, Ingmar, you're seeing micro apps with process mining and outcome driven delivery with bits and pieces of containerized applications. And the applications have evolved, and so does software sales. So does the adoption of technology. And while we might not be a sales podcast here, the important thing to kind of take away is that if you do want to build a successful business, it has to be predicated on your customers being successful. And this was one of the greatest learnings we had with Thomas Law and TSIA. If you guys haven't read it, the Technology as a Service Playbook is an incredibly, incredibly insightful read, because as Citrix was making its shift from being a perpetual to a subscription-based software, the first thing that they realized is that there's a metric around meaningful active use, right? Which exactly. is not only are we going – I mean, the expectations from the customers also changed. It wasn't just show me your technology. It's no. I have a problem, and I'm in this particular vertical. Bring me a subject matter expert that understands manufacturing and where I need to cut costs, and help me design a solution, not just how to install it and implement it, but operationalize it inside of my existing workflows so I can achieve this outcome. It's only when you're partnered in the customer's outcome for success that you will find success as an organization either. And customer success in general has been a big passion of mine. And, you know, thanks to Hector Lima and some of the other folks at Citrix, I got, you know, a front row seat into what that transition and the level of effort that went into that transition really looked like. Because the more you start thinking about it, in fact, Remo 3, while we might not be, you know, a $10 billion organization today, although, you know, we're going to be on our way soon, the idea is that ultimately we want every single one of our customers to be our customers for life. That's the mantra at ETO. The technology platform for me means that I don't want a 96% retention rate for customers. I want a 100% retention rate for customers. Because as long as we're adding value, as long as we're helping them with Windows as a service, as long as we're helping them achieve an outcome, that's something that, you know, they're gaining value from. The moment they stop, they shouldn't pay us.
I'd even go as far as saying that making a customer successful is like having a great product is only part of making a customer successful, right? So if you're focused on selling the product, you're never going to be successful with your customer together. It's bonding, it's creating that partnership, not just in the pre-sales period, but also post-sales. So making sure that your support is top-notch, making sure you have telemetrics to make sure that they're using the product to the full extent of the power of the product, making sure that the customer knows about additional features that are coming that might solve some of their operational issues that you just mentioned, right? It's so much more than just getting that little bit of software or tin or whatever kind of solution you have and bringing it into a customer site. It's taking care of that customer's problem first versus anything else. But it spans multiple pieces of the organization.
And I think this is also like the promise of not so much cloud, but as a service. And I know those two are fairly related. But the good thing about those cloud products and services is that it's as a service, right? It's not consuming a product. Hey, you basically have a partnership that you have that you start. I'm giving you a service and you're giving me money. And that is not that's not a one-time thing. It's not like, hey, it's a 3-year deal and see you later. Yeah. This is a journey where you're building together. So I'm really happy to see that this is finally happening. I think Gartner mentioned consumerization of IT like 10 years ago, right, which is also about device choice and all those kind of things. But this is, I think, consumerization of IT is also what you see happening in who owns the budget. Previously, there was IT. Now you see that the business has the majority of the budget. They get to decide where they want to spend their dollars. And they're going to spend their dollars on the products and services that help them drive the bottom line or whatever they want to do. So, coming back to storytelling, it's about the outcome. So how can you help with the outcome?
I mean, the interesting thing about that too, when you think about that outcome, when you hit the nail on the head with the lines of businesses getting more and more money, right? And to be honest, I mean, if you look at some of these large financial institutions that are out there, they're becoming fintech because retail banking is not a thing anymore. I mean, it is obviously, but it's not the future of banking and FSI in general, right? Financial services are moving towards a fintech model. So their CIOs are taking their limited resources that they have and they're focusing on innovation. They're focusing on building new products to add value to the customers. They don't want these IT services to be focusing on the mundane, testing applications, building servers, all of that stuff. Automation exists for a reason. Automation has come a long way over the last 3 years, whether it's RPA, AI-driven surface automation, doesn't matter. There's a reason that automation has had the boon it has over the last 3 years is so that focus, you know, the focus can move away from, you know, the mundane and focus on the innovation. Because to your point, line of businesses actually have their own kind of IT specialist, or we'll call them an innovator, architect, whatever, that's actually taking and looking at the technology stack for wealth management inside of an organization, saying, we can make these bits better. We can make these changes to our little part of the business. It's not being done synchronously across all the different lines of businesses, which is really an interesting kind of evolution.
It is. And it's actually also a good segue into, let's say, the present day for you. So you are the CTO of Remo 3, and you're on the board of Federate, Cambud, Infinity, and Nekbotics. So you must be very, very busy, man. But can you perhaps talk us through like Remo 3? And you already mentioned like there's some similarity with AppDNA, yet it's different. And if appropriate, what is the relation with the other companies listed?
Yeah, so a small correction there. I am on the board as an operating member for Federate and for Remo 3. I work in an advisory capacity for the sister companies of Camwood and Nexbotics and Infinity. So I advise those organizations. But, you know, it's interesting because from a Remo 3 perspective, and by the way, all five of them are app related, as you can imagine, right? It's either robotic process automation around applications, it's orchestration around application lifecycle management, it's automated testing, or it's actually application modernization itself, moving away from legacy on-prem towards PaaS and re-architecting your applications. So there's quite a few different layers of the onion to peel there. But if I focus on the Remo 3 bit, the thing that was exciting to me around Remo 3 is that while we had started seeing success around automated testing in general, and, you know, digital transformation was, back to Case's point, like we already had multiple delivery and deployment models that were being put out there. So I'm delivering the same application in 15 different ways based on user segmentation, geo, line of business, and a variety of these different factors. What we started seeing is people didn't feel comfortable deploying to their digital workspace because they didn't know what the impact of that change was going to be. And by the way, with 2018 and 2019, there were less and less resources available even prior to COVID to say, I'm going to dedicate human capital to testing applications prior to a migration, prior to a rollout of a patch, prior to moving from ZenApp 6.5 to 7.6. Those things weren't happening anymore. So for Remo 3, what we thought is, you know, we have built out a beautiful automation engine around the testing based on some technology. And I know this isn't a Remo 3 podcast, but it's really kind of focused on the intelligent smoke test, where we can say, give me any Windows workload that can silently install. I will install it. I will launch the application. I will spawn children processes of that parent process so I can go through and ensure that it works. And then ultimately come to you with a binary decision of, yes, this application is compatible. Yes, this application is functional. And by the way, this is the performance around CPU, memory utilization, disk, rewrite, all that stuff over the course of a 3-minute test, all without ever bothering a user, right? So now when you start deploying to 15 workspaces, I don't care whether it's a physical, virtual, or hybrid, or even DAS offering that you want to deploy to. We can test that application against your desired workspace. So now all of a sudden, instead of having to just test once and hope for the best across 15 deployments, you can actually test all 15 deployments without bothering a user. still get the data and say, actually, in Citrix, it runs a little bit better than it does as a native install locally, just because of the fact that they're so close to the home office or whatever it is, right? So ultimately, what we want to answer, and this is kind of, we're a technology platform at the moment, but the goal is to become a business intelligence platform where we can take all this data around the applications that we're answering around, can it install, will it install and run properly, and will it perform well, and say, actually, let's combine it across 15 different workspaces, give you all that data to visualize and say, am I deploying the right application in the right format to the right platform for a good user experience?
So you can also give like a performance impact, like understanding what the impact will be. And if you have sufficient, like large enough data set, which I'm sure you will have, like a cloud-based data set, you can start applying like some form of intelligence and predicting, like, hey, if you deploy this here, then this is the impact it's going to have.
That's exactly it. And I mean, right now, we were lucky, right spot, right time. But with like Windows Virtual Desktop being a very hot topic, I mean, just it's been everywhere. We're starting to see people start planning, which workload should I move? Which applications are going to work? Which ones are multi-session friendly? Can I move it to MSIX? Because ultimately, it doesn't matter if you move a user onto WVD unless you get their 7 or 10 apps that they need to do their job. They're not going to be able to use it. And we're here to kind of accelerate and compress the time frame associated with migration to any workspace, for that matter. I saw K's when I said WVD, just like
that. No, I twitch when people use that word, but that's just me. Just a kind of an observation. During this podcast, you've said you've been lucky more than 3 times, and you can be lucky once, you can be lucky twice, but after the 3rd time, it becomes a trademark, something that you force. So being lucky 3 times is not luck anymore. It's something that you force. It's something that you create. That's just one thing I wanted to mention, because nobody is in the right place in the right time 3 times by being lucky. It's a quality.
I appreciate that. I'll take that as a compliment.
That's as far as no, I can case get with that, compliments, that is, though. Yeah. but being there at the right time in this kind of a crossway of people being hybrid cloud and looking at toe dipping in public cloud, and maybe, you know, having a decent set of workload into public cloud. But, you know, the majority of the customers I talk to, large enterprises, globally, they're looking at being in a hybrid situation, at least for the foreseeable future. So having something that is able to predict where that workload runs best, whatever the workload is, is definitely something that is a competitive advantage against, you know, not just for yourself, but also for the enterprises adopting your software. It's a competitive advantage, because if you're able to predict what the workload will do in kind of certain scenarios, you're able to be cost efficient, operationally wise, but also from a platform perspective, predictability and all of that. That brings so much value, especially given the current complexity of all of the components that we just talked about. Like, we're briefly mentioning these things, but, you know, this is keeping people busy day in, day out, 24/7, right? So although we talk about it as if it's simple, having that technology stack actually makes it a reality.
You're absolutely right, and especially for partners. And that, now that you've added complexity to, in general, for the end user compute landscape around user segmentation, application delivery, software-defined networking, security, storage, compute, sizing. There's a variety of things that go into whether it's hybrid, whether it's on-prem, or whether it is fully DAS. You know, we end up with a situation where we have to look at a lot of different facets to make a decision on, am I doing the best job I can delivering and optimizing my delivery models for apps and for users and workspaces and, like, you know, MSPs and CSPs and all of these partners are coming to us and saying, we'd like to build a service line offering that can leverage some of your technology, some of the Lakeside, Next Thing, Control Up technology as well, to start putting together what a migration plan or what a true deployment delivery strategy should look like around users and applications. And that's kind of, you know, there is a lot of complexity, Case. You're right. I mean, it's not an easy question to answer, and it's not something you'll answer over the course of a weekend either. It's a lot of business requirements gathering, and it's a lot of understanding all of the different use cases.
So Case briefly touched upon a competitive differentiator, and I guess it also comes down to having a competitive strategy. Can you briefly explain what the strategy is of Remo 3? And I can imagine that you target like manual testing, those that are, let's say, underserved, right? You provide automated testing. So that's a good customer to reach. But are there like, what other vendors do you compete with or do you replace? Are there maybe like way more complex application testing solutions? Where should we fit you in the market?
Well, I think it's more around planning and assessment, right? So whenever you're going to make a change, because we deliver automated testing, and listen, it's not user acceptance testing by any means. So for the business critical applications, it still makes sense to take that 5% and go through and hammer them out with a subject matter expert. You should always do that. But the reality is, because change is coming at such a rapid pace, our competitive advantage is we're automating the mundane. Our platform is built on a couple of foundations. Number one, the principle is that it should be completely unattended. Number two, it should be done at scale. And number three, it should be binary. There's no amber. We got rid of amber. It's either red or green. So if it's red, what's wrong with it? How do I fix it? If it's green, let's go. Let's deploy it. And for 85% of your applications, if you can start moving these workloads without any manual intervention, you've achieved success. I mean, that's a thing that's going to happen over the course of a weekend, right? That's something where we say, let's take what was historically a manually driven process and make manual intervention the exception as opposed to the norm, right? So now if we can handle the majority of your applications, that 10% that need manual intervention or remediation or additional UAT, have at it. But you've just compressed your time frame around change management. I'm not just talking about migration to a different workspace, but even just moving from 1803 to 2004 and taking advantage of multi-session. Like that there is a migration. I mean, to me, it's just change management because we're using automation. But ultimately, for us to kind of fit in, it's around assessing the impact of change as it pertains to applications anywhere, right? So from a competitive advantage standpoint, it's around leveraging automation to automate the mundane. But then on the other side of it, if you don't do it, you might be okay. You know, it's fingers crossed, spray and pray. That could also work. Not a super effective strategy based on my 20 years of experience. But the reality is sometimes it's okay to just kind of trickle along as opposed to doing it all at once, right? And status quo tends to be one of our biggest competitors because we haven't seen anyone doing automation at the scale or the way we're doing it.
Yeah, no, and I get that. And I think this is one of those critical pieces in application lifecycle management, is in assessing and keep on assessing, not just doing it once, but for every change that you're going to do, it will have an impact. And if it doesn't, that's great. But you want to know in advance what that impact's going to be.
I'd even go as far as saying that this could apply to operating system lifecycle management as well. We mentioned application lifecycle management, but as you rightfully mentioned, different operating systems have different impact on applications, and applications that will have different impact on operating systems. So what if there's an opportunity for customers to say, I'm migrating to from 1709 to 1909, what happens? Not just application wise, but also performance wise. Because professionally, performance is kind of one of the things that I kind of act on a daily basis. So if we're able to say, I'm keeping my application landscape the same as it is today, I'm just removing the operating system, putting a different version in, what happens on application performance side? And what is the impact on that change? Do I need to get extra kit, or do I have spare kit left, or do I need to burst into public cloud to get capacity? These are kind of things that can define strategy as well.
Yeah, or what if you go from on-prem to cloud, or what if you go from WVD to Citrix, just to name a few. I mean, it's good that
that's an easy one. You'll get back to on-prem anytime soon, but that's just, you know, personal opinion.
All right, but I think with that bombshell, Case, I think we need to start wrapping up this episode. I think you still have a final question that we want to ask Sumit today.
Yes, definitely. So as a new tradition for this second EUC Digest podcast season, we asked our guests to come up with a question for the guest of the next podcast. In our previous podcast, we had Brian Madden from VMware, who asked you the following question. What is something that you're passionate about outside of your core area of what you know that most people don't know about you?
Well, that's an interesting one, because I could either go the healthy route and talk about two sports that I've picked up in the Chicago miserable climate of paddle tennis, platform tennis, and golf, or I could talk about the whiskey, which is also a passion of mine, not nearly as healthy. So how about this? How about I leave it to you guys to prompt which one you have more interest in?
Well, that's look, an interesting one, because I'm into sports and Ingmar is into whiskey, so I'll let Ingmar decide.
No, I'm a sporting Burgundier, so I kind of like to eat and drink, so I have to sport. I like sporting for sure. Yeah. So I'll leave it up to you, Sumit. I mean, whatever, toss the dice and see what happens.
I'll do the sport. I'll start with the sport, and then, you know, over a whiskey one day, I'll share our whiskey story. another reason to come back and sponsor the podcast, you know, that's what we're hoping for. So
noted.
From our side, you know, if we think about, you know, Chicago, I don't know how familiar everyone is with the Chicago climate, but I know it doesn't have a positive connotation. Basically, we have 3 months of golf and then 9 months of gray. So for us, it's been really interesting over the last 4 years, because I can't stand being in the house during the wintertime. I've been so lucky to find this sport called platform tennis, and it's not quite as big in EMEA yet, but there is an equivalent, a semi-near equivalent called padel, where you play, you know, a doubles match inside of a cage, and basically, you know, you have no screen and you can hit it off the walls. And this is played on aluminum decking that has heating underneath of it. So I've spent the last 3 years basically logging 10,000 hours like I do on anything that I care about to try to master this game. And it's resulted in about 4 toenails that have had to be removed from my feet, because you play on aluminum decking and it's just horrifying on your feet. But I get that done in like March, so that by golf season, I'm ready in May to get out and golf. So passions for me.
I can't say you're selling it really well, but it doesn't sound very cool. I mean, I did see that padel. No, picking up here, it seems to be like an evolution of squash. Maybe I've seen it wrong, but there seems to be some similarity. So thank you for sharing that. We'll discuss the whiskey at another occasion, hopefully in person, because that's something I guess we all dearly miss. But this is now also your turn to ask a question to our guest or guests of our next podcast. And no, we are not going to tell you who it is or what the topic is going to be.
Well, see, that makes it more difficult, because all the people that you guys have on the podcast typically end up being my friends. So I could ask a lot of good leading questions for you guys to get some juicy stuff out of. But I think that an interesting one for me, and I've alluded to it a couple of times, little tidbits around TED Talks or podcasts or books that I've found extremely influential throughout my career. So for the next guest, what I'd like to ask is, can you please share one of the books, TED Talks, podcasts, or any social media forum kind of offering that you found incredibly useful in your professional career, and why it's been impactful? For me, it's been the storytelling, and it's really shaped a big chunk of who I am today. It'd be great to understand what types of books and TED Talks are shaping the next guest.
I think that's an excellent question, and thank you so much, Sumit, for being a guest on our show. If people would like to know more about you or to follow you, where should they go?
Well, I'm terrible at social media, so I would say my Twitter has a picture of me with a magnum of wine from like 2009. So I don't think that that's the right place, but please do follow me on LinkedIn. I am fairly active on LinkedIn. Or you can reach me at Sumit.Halvadia@remo3.com. if you have any questions or just want to shoot the breeze. So those are the two places to reach me. And again, I wanted to thank you both for the time and for the invite to come and join a wonderful podcast.
Absolutely. So before we wrap up, I would like to emphasize that we also record a monthly Throwdown podcast, which is published in your favorite podcast player, but also on our YouTube channel, including all of our nice faces on camera. Don't forget to like these videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you would like to join the recording live, we will be sharing a link on Twitter. Don't forget us to follow us on Twitter at UC Digest. Thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed this snack as much as we did, as we tried to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. If you have a topic or a guest for our next episode, if you want to or just want to stay in touch, you can reach out by email on podcast@EUCDigest or on one of these social channels. For now, I want to thank you for listening and wish you an excellent rest of your day. Cheers.